ready for our annual book and record sale coming soon, and we are accepting donations now. The sale will be held sometime this fall. The book and record sale is a great way to help contribute to your community. So do us and yourself a favor. Clear out those books, comics, DVDs, VHS tapes, LPs, and CDs collecting dust around your abode and bring them down to the station, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, during our business hours. Got questions? Contact Jesse at 503-231-8032, extension 213, or online via email, volunteer@kboo.org. Remember, the stuff that you're sick of, others may treasure. Turn your clutter into cash for your community radio station, KBOO.
Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. It's just about 9:01, and coming up for the public affairs segment this morning at right at the top of the hour, Political Perspectives. We'll have an update from Gaza. We'll speak with Mohammed Nabil from Gaza, as well as independent journalist Rania Khalek, and later author and journalist Allison Weir will be the guest. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints presents an encore broadcast of a recent speech given by Ralph Nader in the Bay Area about the issues in his new book, Unstoppable, the Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. At 11 o'clock, we've got the food show. Topics today include urban farming, food banks in the Washington Gorge, Himalayan blackberries, and a traditional French tale about an old woman and her apple tree. And we, as usual, thank you, KBOO members, for your support for KBOO Community Radio. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Thanks for tuning in this morning. سلام الناس لا بيقدم ولا يأخر كلام الناس ملامه وغيره مش أكتر كلام الناس لا بيقدم ولا يأخر كلام الناس ملامه وغيره مش أكتر ليه يا حبيبتي نسمعهم انا عاشق بسمعهم
We are joined in the studio by Mohammed Nabil from Khan Yunis, who is in Portland. And Mohammed, I wonder if you can give us the latest, what you've been hearing from your family now that people have been able to return home. What's the level of destruction in Gaza?
Hey, thank you for having me. So now with the ceasefire, kind of people start going back homes and see what's the distraction and how, you know, how much we lost from this, you know, in terms of buildings and public facilities and all of the other stuff. Basically, if you want to talk about Khan Yunis, Khuza'a is not there anymore, which is horrible.
The whole neighborhood? We're talking about a neighborhood of 5,000 people. Khuza'a is completely destroyed?
Yeah, like nothing actually there now. Like all of what you will find is totally destroyed buildings, towns, like all of that neighborhood, like total, all of it, like destroyed. And the only places that it's not totally destroyed in that neighborhood is unlivable places. So it has to be destroyed to be able to create another building to live, because anybody if go there and live there, it will be a very, very dangerous on the people who live there. You are really lucky if your house like have half damage and it's still livable after some kind of fixing. And the people of that, there is, you are talking about kind of like leaving your house to a shelter and then you leaving the shelter to another house and then going back to the shelter, because like people start, like for example, one of the stories that I hear from my family, that my friend had a family from Khuza'a at his house, and after they're being in a shelter and their shelter being being bombed, which is a school in Khan Yunis. So he got this people, and after that he realized that his brother in Gaza City lost his house. So he ended up having the people in his house, and then the other people who came from the shelter from Khan Yunis says that your brother is more in need to have you because you're his family, and he doesn't have family in Gaza City. So you have to stay with. He has to stay with you, and we will go back to the shelter. And we cannot think now about building houses unless we have the basic needs that we have. So it's not just about building houses and rebuilding, but it's about how to manage your needs and how to manage the new catastrophe that you realize after the war.
These shelters are in United Nations schools. The school year is supposed to begin in September. What is this going to mean for the schools if people are still living in these schools? Will the students be able to go back to school?
Well, actually, this is a big question now being discussed currently between the Palestinian population, not just in terms of the schools and the elementary. You're talking about the universities, colleges, and etc. It's especially because a big number of the schools became shelters. So there are talks about compressed the other schools that it's not been used as shelters, and making the classrooms instead of 40 students capacity to raise it to be an 80 or 70 student capacity in order to have this save the school year start on its time and not destroy the schedule and the form, and at the same time give the people the ability to stay in the schools while they manage themselves and find houses or shelters. That's in terms of the schools, the elementary schools till the high schools. But in terms of universities, there's a big problem now. It's been in front of the students who are, we are all the time we have a summer semester that's been destroyed by the war, because all the summer basically been affected by the war that's been on Gaza currently. So now people don't know, should we continue the summer? Should we stop it? Should we delay it to the next summer? Should we merge it with the fall semester? Or what's the idea? And now this is kind of a big distraction for any student who is already registered for a summer semester and already built his or her plans, and now it's been destroyed.
A lot of people in the U.S. May not know this about the people of Gaza and Palestine in general, but people there are very committed to education. I wonder if you could talk about that as a value for Palestinians, why it's so important.
Well, in terms of education, since the very, very beginning, we knew that this is our only weapon to stand and say we are people, we have the right to exist, and this is our mission in the world. We don't have F-16, we don't have nuclear weapons, but we have the education. Gaza might be the highest, one of the highest, maybe the highest or the second highest overpopulated area in the world, but also it's one of the highest educated people in a small area in the world. You're talking about 30% of the Gaza Strip population have a master's degree or more.
The universities, many of them have been damaged. I saw pictures of the Islamic University of Gaza sustaining damage. Are many of the other universities also suffering from damage from the last 2 months of bombardment?
Yeah, definitely. Basically, there is about 4 buildings been totally destroyed in the IUB, the Islamic University in Gaza. And also Al-Aqsa University, which is a university beside the Islamic University, it's also have been affected. It's not, and there is damages happen in Al-Aqsa University in Khan Yunis, which is my city. So it's kind of two branches of the same university in Gaza and Khan Yunis been affected by the bombardment that it's happened. Like Al-Aqsa University in Khan Yunis, like there is about two buildings had half damaged, according to the Man News. Not just the Islamic University, but the Al-Aqsa University. And here, in terms of the public facilities that serve everybody, we have to talk about how many hospitals been damaged and destroyed. Like there is about at least three hospitals being totally destroyed in the last and the current bombardment, and also the three UN schools. Those have been recorded by the UN leadership and administration in the Gaza Strip. And there is other schools that is under the Palestinian government or Palestinian authority in the Gaza Strip been destroyed and affected by the bombardment. More than 50 mosques been destroyed. When the Israelis destroy the mosques in Ramadan back in a few weeks ago, it was the Al-Qadr night, which is the night of power in the Muslim faith. And there is this Christian priest, he show up and he says, if the Israelis bombed your mosques, please come to our church and do your prayer. And that night, a huge number of Muslims been into the church, pray there, start their fasting there, and till now there is people sheltering in the churches in the Gaza Strip. And this is something that everybody have to know about this kind of society of the Gaza Strip. We are really know exactly what it means to be one, existed on a piece of land together, live together, having the same destiny, having the same goal, which is peace and justice and equality for everybody.
Well, thanks so much. I've been speaking with Mohammed Nabil here in our Portland studios of KBOO. Mohammed is from Khan Yunis, and his family is there and has been suffering through the last month and a half of Israeli bombardment in one of the most heavily bombed areas in the Gaza Strip in Khan Yunis. Thank you, Mohammed, for being with us today.
Thank you very, very much. And I hope next time we will, you know, have an interview with more happy news about the Strip. Thanks.
Thanks so much. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News. A blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames. Nothing remains, just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down Gaza tonight. Women and children alike, murdered and massacred night after night. While the so-called leaders of countries afar debated on who's wrong or right. But their powerless words were in vain. The bombs fell down like acid rain. But through the tears and the blood and the pain, you could still hear that voice through the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night.
can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight.
We are joined on the line now by Rania Khalik. She is a prolific Twitterer, a blogger, and a contributor to sites like truthout.org and the electronicintifada.net. Most recently, you've written a piece about an incident in Khuza in southern Gaza in which Palestinians were used by the Israeli military as human shields. Can you describe that incident, what you found out?
Anybody who's been paying attention to this latest round of bombing has repeatedly heard the Israeli government accuse Palestinians in Gaza of using innocent civilians as human shields, and that's why so many civilians are dying. Of course, there's no documented evidence of this happening, but what is increasingly clear is that there's evidence emerging that it's Israel, that Israeli soldiers, invading Israeli soldiers who use Palestinian civilians as human shields. And like you mentioned, in Khuza, in southern Gaza, there, the Euromid Observer for Human Rights has released this video testimony of a man who was in his home with about 50 to 60 of his relatives sheltering in his basement. And the Israeli soldiers that came into Gaza basically stormed into the home. And the grandfather of this household held up a white flag and tried to alert them to the fact that there were women and children sheltering in the house. And the Israeli soldiers shot him dead. He was in his 60s. And then after that, they basically rounded up the people in the house and handcuffed them and forced them to stand in front of windows throughout the house as they fired from behind them. And this included children as well. It sounds horrifying, and it is, but it's not the first time that there's been testimonies like this. During Operation Cast Lead, there were also similar testimonies from people inside Gaza saying that Israeli soldiers had forced them to, stand in front of the windows. In some cases, they forced, this time around, there's a 17-year-old Palestinian who a group of Israeli soldiers forced for 5 days to walk in front of them at gunpoint with the bomb-sniffing dog unit. And this happened as well during Operation Cast Lead. There was an 11-year-old boy during Operation Cast Lead who was forced to walk ahead of Israeli soldiers at gunpoint while they were under fire. This is the clearest example of using a human shield to get. It's as shocking as it is. Israel has a well-documented history of using Palestinians in this manner, particularly children. And of course, no one's ever been held accountable for this, which basically guarantees it'll continue to happen.
And what about this Israeli claim that Hamas is using civilians as human shields? In your research, have you found any evidence of that?
No. And in fact, journalists who have been in Gaza have said that they haven't seen any proof of this either. It's an unsubstantiated claim. The only proof behind this claim is the cartoon sketches that the Israeli military, the Israeli spokesperson put out on Twitter. That's it. But you hear this claim echoed over and over again and invoked by not just Israeli officials, but U.S. officials as well, to basically justify what is, the wholesale slaughter of civilians in Gaza.
Does it seem like there's going to be a return to the all-out war on Gaza, or what is your analysis on where those negotiations are headed?
Well, it seems like what's happening is, you know, there's the Palestinian demands are pretty clear. You know, lift the illegal, crippling siege that Israel's placed on Gaza for the past 7 or almost 8 years. And, you know, basically they're very reasonable humanitarian demands coming from Hamas. And Israel, just, you know, despite all the negotiations, you know, according to reports, the Israelis are ignoring these demands. And so it seems to me as though they're trying to just indefinitely extend this truce, which really, you know, it's a truce as in, like, let's hold our fire, but, you know, while this truce is taking place, while there's a temporary ceasefire, Gaza is still under crippling siege. You've got 10,000 people who've been injured, most of them very seriously injured, and, you know, from the pictures that we're seeing, it looks like there's been a massive earthquake. But there's no, you know, international humanitarian relief taking place because Gaza is sealed off. So just because, you know, Israel's kind of holding its fire right now, I mean, let's remember, there, you know, over the past couple of days, there's also been shots fired at, you know, at fishermen in Gaza. So, you know, it seems to me that this is just kind of an extended, indefinite truce, kind of an attempt for Israel to keep in place the siege without having to actually address these demands, while still being able to attack whenever it feels like it, you know, whether it's, like, you know, by just kind of shooting from gunboats or shooting at farmers like it has been in between these ceasefires, between these bombing campaigns.
We've been talking about this disconnect between U.S. lawmakers and the reality on the ground, and how their bills that they've brought up are just completely based on what a very right-wing Israeli government line is, while not actually looking at what's happening on the ground. As an example, the U.S. Senate has called for the UN agency that works in Gaza to be investigated, but have not called for any investigation of allegations of Israeli war crimes. What do you know about this bill that the Senate is pushing right now to have UNRWA, the UN agency in Gaza, investigated?
I mean, this is like a cartoon. I mean, it's just so insane. This UN agency was created because, you know, there's this Palestinian refugee problem that's unlike any other. For over 60 years, it's unresolved because Palestinian refugees are prevented from returning to the homes they were kicked out of or the land they were kicked out of because they're the wrong ethnicity. So the UN agency that works with Palestinian refugees in Gaza, in Palestinian refugees all over the Middle East, because they're everywhere, you've got this bipartisan effort by people in the Senate, you know, calling for investigations into the role that they play, you know, in helping Hamas. There's some ridiculous. I mean, there was two instances where there was like a rocket launcher or a rocket found in an abandoned UN school, and the UN agency turned these weapons over, or the launcher over, to the police forces in Gaza, which is what, you know, you would do in any case. You turn it over to the security. And so Israel considers any police force in Gaza to be, you know, to be Hamas militants. Because Gaza's not allowed to have a police force, which is why Israel actually targets police officers, you know, in these strikes that it does. But anyways, so now there's this effort by the senators to launch this investigation. Meanwhile, they're actively and have always actively blocked any sort of investigation into any potential Israeli criminality in Gaza. You know, let's remember, Israel shelled at least 7 UN-designated shelters where displaced families were sheltering. These are families that Israel pulled to leave and flee their homes. And they did, and then people died fleeing to the places that they were told to go. So it's shocking, and really just, you know, it's like a cartoon, it's like a Twilight Zone.
In the last couple of days on your Twitter account, which is followed by many people, you've made some parallels to between what's happening in Ferguson, Missouri, where an unarmed black teenager was shot by police this past weekend, and what has happened to the Palestinians in Gaza. Can you talk about what you see as a parallel there?
Well, actually, it's people on the ground in Ferguson. After this unarmed black teenager, Michael Brown, was shot dead by a police officer who's yet to be named. He was shot at least 10 times with his arms raised in the air, surrendering to police for no reason, or it seems like no reason. After this happened, the police department, basically cracked down on protesters, on residents who were upset that, one of their neighbors, one of their friends, one of their loved ones was shot dead. They cracked down in a really alarming way. Pictures coming out of Ferguson, it looks like occupied territory. You see police dressed in camouflage with assault rifles, pointing assault rifles at unarmed residents, and using tear gas against protesters, and running around in what look like, tanks and unarmored personnel vehicles that look like tanks. It's a really big show of this militarized police force. And there's like a no-fly zone declared over Ferguson. You've got people on the ground there who are basically saying, what is this, Gaza? Like, is this Palestine? Like, is this occupied territory? And I think it's a really compelling comparison to make because, a lot of communities in this country, a lot of marginalized, poor communities in this country, communities of color, tend to feel like they do live in occupied territory where police officers have free reign to brutalize and kill them arbitrarily. And this is very much like how Palestine functions under Israeli control. There's definitely parallels to be made. And there's also the fact that a lot of U.S. police departments train with and go on, trips to Israel and try in an effort to try and emulate Israeli police and soldiers. And that's not to say that our own police forces would be any less brutal if there wasn't that connection with Israel and training with Israeli police. But it's just the fact that, Israel is an occupying power and American police departments are learning from the way Israel treats Palestinians and applying that to the way they treat our police communities in this country.
All of this is continuing. We are unclear as to whether the negotiations will actually get anywhere in that the Israelis are participating only indirectly and the Hamas representatives are threatening to walk out, if not having walked out already, saying that they are not getting any type of satisfactory response from the Israelis. Do you have any hope in the negotiations that are going on?
Well, the negotiations are being led by Egypt, which is the Egyptian military coup regime that's in charge right now is very hostile towards Palestinians and hates Hamas because Hamas would be is tied to the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the Egyptian regime's enemy at the moment. And so, this whole time, the Egyptian government and the U.S. government have given Israel cover to continue its violations of international law in Gaza. And so I really don't, and as long as Egypt is leading this and as long as the U.S. is involved, I don't think there's any chance for actual justice to be served from these negotiations. And by justice, I mean a lifting of this crippling illegal siege, which amounts to collective punishment against a population of 1.8 million people, 80% of whom are refugees, who've just been bombed for 30 days straight, and have no access to the outside world, have no access to release from the international community because they're sealed off from the world. So, until that happens, I don't think that Hamas is going to give up that demand. And they have every right to demand it. It's a demand for basic human rights to lift the siege. And I don't think Israel, as long as no one pressures Israel, it's not going to, the U.S. isn't going to pressure Israel. Egypt's not going to pressure Israel. The international community doesn't seem to be doing anything to push Israel to abide by international law. So, as long as no one's pressuring Israel, Israel's going to continue to, there's no way Israel's going to lift this siege. So I unfortunately, for the time being, it seems like it's going to kind of continue indefinitely in the way it has been, where, you know, for a couple of years, it's quiet, you know, for it's quiet, and just, you know, the people in Gaza sort of suffer and die quietly from this brutal siege, and then Israel, you know, initiates a bombing campaign and kills a lot of people. It seems to be that this is the cycle.
Wow. Well, let's hope that this cycle is broken and that people are able to live in equality and dignity in Gaza. I've been speaking with Rania Khalik. She is a blogger, a writer. Her most recent piece, Israeli Army Uses Gaza Children as Human Shields, can be found on electronicintifada.net. You can also follow her on Twitter at Rania Khalik. Thank you so much for joining us today, Rania.
Thanks for having me on.
This is Jinka Soderberg with KBOO News.
1.8 million people surrounded on all sides. Refugees since 48, since 67 occupied. The only reason they're not starving is down to the UN. Most have never left, they're stuck in the lion's den. The most crowded place on earth, and there they'll stay. They can't visit cousins, half hour's drive away. Drones overhead, constantly. Who will die tomorrow? A daily mystery in Gaza. The settlers moved out, the fighter jets moved in Gaza there's just no way that you can win. You can't take out a copter with an antiquated gun, you're just a target sitting in the sun. Waiting for your death to come raining from the sky, where the end really is nigh. You can hear a sonic boom and see a flashing light every hour of the day, every hour of the night in Gaza. There are no shelters, nowhere you can hide. Life is nothing like it is on the other side. There's nothing post about the traumatic stress. There's never more, usually less. And still some people wonder, they insist on asking why anyone would be so mad as to reply, so mad as to think that it might make sense to lob some missiles over the fence from Gaza. From Gaza. From Gaza.
And this is Jenka Soderberg live here on KBOO this Wednesday morning, August 20th. And we have been hearing some pretty bad reports coming out of Gaza over the last night. There was some hope over the last 6 or 7 days in which a ceasefire was holding and a longer-term ceasefire was being negotiated. Unfortunately, last night, that ceasefire broke down. At midnight, when it expired, Israeli missiles began to rain down on Gaza once again. And many people around the world found themselves thinking, not again. 21 people were killed last night, and the most recent airstrike, two children were killed. The wife of the head of the armed wing of Hamas and child of Mohammed Deif were killed. Her name, Widad Deif, and her child, Ali, were killed when the home was bombed in what was presumed to be an assassination attempt by missile. So this is what's happening right now in Gaza. The truce has broken down, and we are joined on the line by Allison Weir. She is the head of the Council for the National Interest Foundation and If Americans Knew, which is a website if you are looking for background information on particularly U.S. involvement in the Israel-Palestine conflict, and for statistics and information on the conflict itself is a great resource, ifamericansknew.org. Allison, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with this truce. Are the demands made by the Palestinians unreasonable? Why is it that this truce seems so elusive?
Well, the demands are really very normal demands. The people in Gaza want to live normal lives, to be able to come and go from their own country without an external force preventing them. Fishermen want to be able to fish the way, you know, fishermen normally do. This is the livelihood, without Israeli forces firing on them, preventing them, abducting them, sometimes killing them. They want to be able to have supplies, be able to come into Gaza, medical supplies, food, diapers, all the normal things that people around the world want. They want to end the siege that Israel has implemented and the U.S. and other parties have joined. That's been going on since 2007 on a population that's, you know, now about 1.8 million people, families, women, children, just normal families being prevented from getting the normal necessities of life. These are very normal and appropriate demands that Israel is making. The U.S., it appears,
that the people in Gaza are making.
The people in Gaza are making these, that's right.
And in Israel, the demand is that all Palestinian fighters lay down their arms and that Israel retain control over some section of Gaza. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's right. So
Is there any equivalent demand that Israelis lay down their arms and disarm completely?
No, there's not. And here Israel has an extremely powerful military. It consistently violates international laws. It uses U.S. weaponry in ways that violate U.S. laws. There should be certainly demands from the U.S. government that it stop violating our own laws with this weaponry. But you hear very little about that aspect.
And I just want to talk, I want to move into U.S. involvement in this, or U.S. complicity, as may be the case. You mentioned violation of U.S. law. I understand that part of that is the U.S. Arms Export Control Act. Can you talk about how Israel has violated and how U.S. shipment of arms to Israel violate the U.S. Arms Export Control Act?
Well, the Arms Export Control Act requires that our weaponry only be used in defensive matters. Israel consistently uses them in offensive cases. It also, some U.S. laws specifically talk about some types of weaponry, cluster bombs, for example, only be used under certain circumstances in uncrowded areas, for example. Israel has violated that consistently, beginning with Lebanon a few decades ago, and continues to violate, to use our U.S. weaponry in ways that violate the specific laws regarding those weapons. Sometimes this is brought up, but usually it's not. As I'm sure your listeners are aware, there's a very powerful Israel lobby that largely drives our policies. We've just been looking into really the budgets of the Israel lobby. Many people, I think, even that are aware of its power, underestimate how huge it is. You know, we've been gathering a list of all the different organizations in the United States that publicly acknowledge that they advocate on behalf of Israel. There are dozens and dozens of them. The combined net worth is over $6 billion that is used to advocate on behalf of Israel in the United States, to push for policies that will quote, benefit Israel, even though they often certainly are illegitimate policies, and even though they, in many, many cases, harm the United States. We have a $6 billion lobby in the United States working on behalf of Israel and protecting, shielding Israel, even in the United States, from violating American laws.
And some people actually advocate that the U.S. should have an ally there in the Middle East, and Israel is our best and most likely ally, given that it is, at least in name, a democracy. How is the U.S. relationship with Israel actually benefiting the U.S. As far as security in the Middle East, or is it?
It's not. Recently, for example, in the Israeli media, this is consistently understood and written about. Just recently, I believe it was in the Jerusalem Post, there was an article by a veteran Israeli diplomat named Alon Pincus, who has held a number of high posts in the Israeli government and was ambassador to the U.S., I believe, at one point, or to the U.N. And he was actually quite angry at Netanyahu's, the ferocity of Netanyahu's attacks on Gaza and the way he has treated the American president, stating that Israel, the strategic partnership that supposedly exists, Pincus wrote, actually only benefits Israel. It's of no benefit to the U.S. So he was very concerned that Netanyahu was endangering the strategic partnership because it benefits Israel. The U.S. gets nothing out of it. Mm-hmm. There's an article today by a former CIA analyst who's also president of the Council for the National Interest, Philip Giraldi, who talks about, once again, the many ways that Israel is the opposite of an ally. There have been a number of reports over the past year about the amount of spying it does on the U.S. I think behind China and Russia, it spies on the U.S. more than anybody else. There's a whole movement funded by the Israeli government of, quote, perception management or influence operations, in which they governmentally paid individuals, both students and soldiers, adopt false identities and go on the internet, especially places like Facebook and Twitter, to post comments that are actually coming from the Israeli government in a very managed and systemic manipulation of the United States.
Mm. Again, I'm speaking with Allison Weir. She is the head of the Council for the National Interest Foundation and If Americans Knew. We are willing to take your calls. If you have calls for Allison Weir, she has a wealth of knowledge, particularly on the U.S. relationship with Israel. And the phone number to call, if you do have a question or comment, is 503-231-8187. Again, 503-231-8187. We've been hearing this morning about the situation in the Gaza Strip. Over 1,900 Palestinians. Some are saying it's up to 2,000 Palestinians, including around 500 children, have been killed since July 8th, 79% of whom were civilians, according to the United Nations. Among the dead are 16 healthcare personnel, 12 journalists, 11 United Nations employees, and over 10,000 Palestinians have been wounded. During the same time period, 3 Israeli civilians, 64 Israeli soldiers have been killed. The vast majority of those soldiers were killed while actively invading Gaza. Over 10,000 Palestinian homes have been destroyed, and that may well be a very low estimate. Allison, these numbers are horrific. The attacks on Gaza now restarting again last night with missiles beginning to rain down again, killing 21 people. How is the U.S. complicit? Is the blood on our hands?
It certainly is. You know, American taxpayers, without our really authorization whatsoever, but it is our money that keeps going to Israel and the weaponry provided by the United States that gives Israel such massive power that it can completely ignore normal requirements of humanity and international law. Not only does the United States provide a massive amount of money to Israel, far more than we give to any other country on earth, but we also shield Israel from international consequences. Consistently, there are vetoes of Security Council resolutions that the rest of the world is in favor of, that would condemn Israeli violence, that would potentially rein in Israeli violence, that would end violence, you know, certainly reduce violence altogether that would benefit everybody, I feel, in the region, are consistently vetoed by U.S. representatives. And this is going on in most cases without the American public being adequately informed about what's being done in our name and with our money. We have a U.S. media that consistently gives us very much Israel spin, that when an Israeli child or baby is killed, it's very minor news and often buried down in the story. The amount of money that goes to Israel from the U.S. is virtually never mentioned in any of these stories. So the average American thinks this is just a confusing conflict. Probably Hamas is to blame. They don't really know what Hamas is, other than the U.S. media consistently say it's categorized as a terrorist organization, never acknowledging that Hamas is the elected representative of the people in Gaza, that it was an elected government, and what numerous observers saw was a fair election. This is virtually never included in these news stories. The fact that Israeli forces have killed far more civilians for many, many years than the Palestinian resistance forces, including Hamas, have ever killed. Mm. So if one defines a terrorist organization as a group that kills civilians, which is a fair way to define it, really the Israeli government fits that definition to a far greater degree than Hamas and Palestinian resistance forces would fit that definition. And yet, to read the U.S. media, you would never learn that fact.
It's been pointed out over the last month and a half of this ongoing assault on Gaza that if Hamas's objective were to kill Israeli civilians, they are really bad at it because they have not been doing so, whereas if their objective is to attack Israeli soldiers, they've been more effective, whereas the Israeli military and Israeli Air Force have killed far, far more civilians than fighters. And on your website, ifamericansknew.org, Allison, you've got analysis and studies of the U.S. media, as you just talked about the disparity in coverage on the front of the website. You can see a chart of how many Israeli and Palestinian children have been killed from the year 2000 to the present. 131 Israeli children have been killed by Palestinians, and 1,997 Palestinian children have been killed by Israelis. In the U.S. media coverage, it's a far different picture where you don't actually see that disparity in numbers. You see the Israeli deaths reported far more than the Palestinian deaths. We've got a caller, Naya, on the line. Naya, do you have a question or comment?
I do. Thank you. I guess I want to ask, number one, what can we do to dispel these myths like, oh, Hamas is a terrorist organization? From everything I've read, they're just kind of like a resistance, and they do anything that anybody would do in a position that they're in. Number two, I would ask what we're doing to work with mainstream media to dispel some of those myths. And number three, I would like to ask, is there any way, and I being a homeowner in Portland with two spare bedrooms, is there any way we could host a refugee family? How do we get in touch with people to get them out of there? Is there any way to help them or get them aid or get them somewhere safe? Those are my questions. Thank you.
Thanks. Those are great questions. Allison, what can we do? Excellent. Let's start with that.
That's right. I mean, those are excellent questions. There are a number of things we can do, despite the fact that, we have huge obstacles. Once again, the way that policies change is, first of all, more Americans learning what's going on and then taking political action, telling our elected representatives what we want and what we do not want. So to me, the first thing is to tell others about what's going on, share this information, put on events, invite people to your home, put on an event on your local campus, perhaps at a church or synagogue or mosque, put on events to educate people. And then I feel it's very important as American citizens to tell our elected representatives what we expect from them. And I certainly don't expect them to send any more of my tax money to Israel. It perpetuates the violence. It creates tragedy. It certainly creates anger, very dangerous and valid anger against the United States, since we're funding such a tragedy, creating such tragedy in the Middle East.
And Naya also asked about the mainstream media, how to address this disparity of what the mainstream media is reporting and how different it is from the reality on the ground.
I sort of see a two-pronged approach. One is to consistently confront the media with this, the local media, giving them factual information and show that how distorted their information is. Often local media don't know how bad they are. They're taking the reports from the Associated Press and the New York Times, and that's where the bias usually stems from. I think it's valuable. You know, this sounds minor, but I think it's very valuable to write factual letters to the editor and op-eds. Whenever these do get in, that's a major victory because people are reading information that they would not otherwise have. At the same time, I feel going out directly to the public through public events that expose media bias and distortion is very valuable so that people start to realize that when they think they're reading objective media reports, that's not what they're getting. So I think both working within the media and then out directly with the public is very important. Mm. And the third question about hosting a refugee family and how to help the people of Gaza directly, I find that people in Gaza really consistently tell us that they don't really want charity. They want us to change our policies. So while charity is sometimes essential, medical supplies and food, et cetera, are essential, there are massive humanitarian agencies around the United States, including USAID often, including UN agencies, et cetera, that do get in aid to Gazans and keep them alive to a certain degree. And this has been going on for decades. So the Band-Aids are given to people. You know, it's never sufficient, but this is an ongoing effort done by people and governments around the entire world. American citizens are the ones that potentially have the power to cure the whole problem rather than just giving Band-Aids. So most Gazans will tell me, and I know they've told others, what they want from us is a political movement, a grassroots movement, to change the American policies that give Israel the power with which it is oppressing Palestinians in this very, one ferocious military assault after another, as Jenka, you mentioned.
So, yes, give to charity groups, but don't make that your only action. One of the ones I've heard mentioned is the Palestinian Children's Relief Fund, also the Red Crescent, the Palestinian Red Crescent, if you want to help with the emergency situation, but also make sure you call your congressperson as a second step. Don't just give money to the charities at this point. We also have Thomas on the line with a question. Thomas?
Yes, I have a comment leading to a question. First, I want to say that I really appreciate the insight your guest has to offer in the larger discussion. But my comment is that I'm really very much concerned that the average concerned person in the United States that does have some clues to what's going on in these crimes against the people of Gaza and elsewhere in Palestine, I fear that they're not really seeing the larger perspective related to how literally hostage the United States Congress is, and that's both Democrat and Republican, to the Israel lobby. You know, there was an important academic paper just a few years ago, I think it was 2006 or 2007, by a couple of political scientists, John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt. They co-authored this paper that was entitled Israeli Lobby in U.S. Foreign Policy. And it, about a 60-page paper. You can get it online in a PDF. It's easy to find. Just Google it. And, it lays out chapter and verse in a very, very clear way how the Zionist, the radical Zionist lobby hogties Congress. And, my question is, how are people, let's say, particularly of a more progressive stripe, going to effectively act, if they're not even aware of the fact that in their own political party is not, these forces aren't external to their political party. These forces are internal. You have some of the chief funders across the board for the DNC and political parties, including President Obama, being people like Betty Lou Saltzman, who's daughter of billionaire slumlord and real estate developer, Philip Klesnik, who's a
who's a staunch, hawkish Israel supporter. You got people like media mogul Naeem Sabah, who, you know, his direct quote is, I'm a one-issue guy, and my issue is Israel, who pumps tons of money. He was one of the chief supporters of Hillary Clinton and also Barack Obama. And the list is, you know, Lester Crown, who's the son of Chicago financier Henry Crown and his empire with big stakeholders in General Dynamics. And these people were all involved in the rise of not just, particularly of Obama, but indeed backing these hard lines. And, of course, on the Republican side, you've got the notorious Sheldon Adelstein, who is a staunch Israeli right-wing supporter, who's a casino mogul, and you got Paul Singer, who's a big hedge fund mogul, who's a staunch Zionist booster. And so essentially what you have is you have both parties trying to outbid each other in who can puppet and parrot the Israeli line. And then in addition to that, you have all the funding, all the campaign contributions from General Dynamics and Raytheon and all the other companies that sell this, that most of this so-called aid to Israel is no more than just a gift card that we give them so they can buy weapons back from the United States. So,
well, Thomas, I want to have Allison address we only have a couple minutes, and I want to have you address how to break the hold of the Israel lobby in Washington.
Thank you.
I agree. Thank you for the comment. That's exactly what's going on. You know, there's this massive purchasing of both political parties, the Democratic Party certainly every bit as much as the Republican Party. Haim Saban, that you just mentioned, and dual Israeli citizen in the U.S., just announced how much money he was going to give Hillary Clinton. So we will see the media portraying, look at Hillary Clinton, the first female president, you know, to be elected. This will be a wonderful triumph for the American public, just as Barack Obama was touted as, look at this wonderful first African-American president. And many of us love to see, you know, the idea that there are no longer these limitations, gender or race limitations. But what many Americans don't know is, well, there's Hillary Clinton is going to be funded by Haim Saban and others in the Israel lobby, and that's what's going on. The same thing happened with Barack Obama. The article that you mentioned about the Israel lobby was excellent. It's also a book called The Israel Lobby by John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt. People can buy that. I've also just written a book called Against Our Better Judgment that shows that the power of this lobby has gone back many decades, you know, many decades. This kind of situation was already occurring by the time Truman was running against Dewey in the late 1940s. Both Dewey and Truman were already competing for who could be, at that time, more Zionist because Israel didn't exist yet. But again, they were going for these donations, the media news that benefits them if they take a pro-Zionist position. The way to get around this is for us, again, to inform more people about what's going on and then to start voting on this issue. Many of us have other issues that are extremely important, the economy, the, you know, health care, you know, issues of justice of many sorts. But until we let our elected representatives know that we will no longer vote for somebody that will perpetuate policies that are creating this massive tragedy in the Middle East and massive danger to Americans, we will continue to get people that will support Israel, right or wrong, and usually wrong. So I feel it's very important for people to start saying to their elected representatives, we will no longer accept this kind of representation.
And unfortunately,
people are starting to do that.
I hope that people are starting to do that and are looking up some of these things that you talked about. IfAmericansKnew.org is a place where you can find Allison Weir's book, Against Our Better Judgment, about the history of the special relationship. And if people are interested also in seeing Hillary Clinton's true colors, look up a recent interview she did with Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic, where you see her advocating for a war with Iran and all kinds of militarism and other horrific things. We're going to go out with part of a song from David Rovics. We heard David Rovics earlier this hour, and this song is What Do You Call It?
Mm-hmm. call it when a movement takes up arms and seizes power by the barrel of a gun, moves into the homes of those they've dispossessed and says this whole country is ours now that we've won. What do you call a government that forces families from their homes and turns them into refugees? All the while complaining of these dirty tent dwellers that it's they who want to drive us into the sea. What do you call a government that builds walls around the ghettos and only looks at you through sniper sights? Who uses your cheap labor to build those very walls while they tell the world how they believe in human rights? What do you call a government that makes war upon their neighbors, who annexes land for living room, who conducts a foreign policy based on threats and bombing raids, whose opponents often end up in a prison or a tomb? What do you call a government who talks of enemies within and seals off the camps to make sure they cannot eat, who keeps their prisoners on diets to guarantee an early death with their mantra, history cannot repeat? What do you call a government that puts numbers on the arms of the people that they torture and arrest, whose soldiers commit war crimes systematically while they proclaim their conduct is superior at best? What do you call a government that bombs its starving subjects after taking from them everything they had, whose citizens are soldiers, brainwashed to believe their opponents are fanatics, terrorists or mad? What do you call it when a movement takes up arms and seizes power by the